Accession number 26729, Reel 2.
Bob Cherry, Reel 2. We were talking about anti-submarine operations in the Bay of Biscay.
Yep.
Could you start from the top, as it were, and describe, one operation, an operation from scratch? Would you have information as to where submarines were, or would you just go out looking for them, for example?
Basically, just go out looking for them. The area we were covering was where the U-boats went out from France and back again. So you had these musketry patrols where we all covered, so nobody overlapped.
So you all had a specific
area? We all had a specific area to do, which was about 5.5 to 6 hours, because we had to fly out to that position.
And how many of you were in the air at the same time? Was it a continuous
thing? Always a continuous day and night, 7 days a week. I mean, there was no arguments about it. And as far as we could, we covered as much of the Bay of Biscay that we could. I mean, we went down as far as the... what was it called? Cape. I can't remember it, but it's off the Spanish coast. And we used to stay just outside the... limits laid down, the international line. But that was done, and I say had one part, the next chap on the squadron would have another part, and then the other squad was doing it at the same time. And so basically the object of the exercise was to try and keep the U-boat underwater. Now, if you were fortunate or to meet up with the U-boat, well, we used to pick it up on radar, which at that time in the Wellington was known as ASV Mark II, which was only one of the pioneers. It wasn't all that good, but it was useful. So that you could pick up a U-boat at about 10 to 15 miles, and then we'd home in on it, and then drop down to an operational height of about 500 feet, go over the U-boat, straddling it if you could with the depth charges, so half of them fell one side and half of them fell the other. Then up and away, because your depth charges had all gone. Now at that time we were getting very good overall. I mean, not just our squadron, but everybody was getting very good indeed. And the Germans started to use JU-88s. Which were one of their sort of fighter bombers, which was an extremely good aircraft. And I had the misfortune to meet up with eight of them one day, but I was fortunate enough. Our orders were that if you were attacked by these eight JU-88s, was to dump your depth charges and turn west, turn them away from their bases so they couldn't come too far. But it just so happened, to the west it was clear blue skies, to the east it was cloud. So I turned east and got into cloud, and that was it. That was over and done with.
Can you describe the crew of your Wellington? How many did you have, and what were their different functions?
I had a crew of six. I had a co-pilot by the name of Jimmy Ayling. Navigator was Tug Wilson. And the... three wireless op AGs. Now, the three wireless op AGs, one went into the front turret, one went into the rear turret, and one was doing the radio work. Then after a half an hour, I used to swap them around so that nobody got tired or bored with being where they were. And that was what we kept up, because looking at the ASV at that time, the navigator, that was a tiring job. So sometimes the co-pilot would take over from the navigator to look at the screen, and then sometimes I would do the same, hand over to the co-pilot and then look at the screen for about half an hour, and then back on duty again.
And so everybody did gunnery work as well?
Yeah.
Who dropped the depth charges? Who was
responsible? Navigator. He guided you in. He guided you in from a height of, I think, again, it was about... 250 feet, I think it was, and he had got his prone position in the front of the aircraft, and he'd guide you in. and it was he that actually dropped the depth charges.
And how many would you drop?
8, I think it was.
For each side?
For each side, if you could. Not yours, could.
And how many submarines do you think you hit?
Me? I never saw one.
You've flown away before?
Well, no, I just didn't see them. I mean, they nothing appeared to me. But, I mean, it was only years afterwards that I realised how many crews we'd lost on 547 Squadron through anti-submarine work. I was absolutely shattered.
Being shot down by German fighters?
Being shot down by German fighters and being shot down by the U-boats. Because the U-boats, they came back pretty fierce. And so that was one of those things that we found out. We lived a very cloistered life as a crew. I mean, when we first joined the squadron, we had the ground crew that looked after our aircraft. Then we had our crew. And when we weren't working, all of us went out together. We never saw anybody else. And then they took the ground crew away from us to do what they called was centralised servicing, because that was a more efficient way of getting the aircraft serviced, although it meant we lost personal contact with our ground crew.
So to ask you, could you describe the setup at the at Davidston? More, I mean, how many aircraft were there in the squadron? How many different crews?
I think it was 12 aircraft in the squadron, and at the time we were there, there was just 2 squadrons, ourselves and the Polish squadron, who were doing the same job of work that we were doing. It was a brand new airfield. It had only opened for the war, and it wasn't in an extremely good spot because the weather used to come down pretty smartish, and so you had to divert yourself somewhere else. Very primitive. All old-fashioned huts, Elson huts, were they? Something like that. And that dripped with water from the ceiling or roof. It wasn't very comfortable at all. But the work had to be done, and that was it.
So you were living in these huts?
Yep.
How many of you to a hut?
2 crews.
There'd be 12 approximately,
yeah.
12 people.
Yeah, of which there was two small rooms for the captain, and then the rest of the crew were in an old long barrack room, all side by side.
So you had, I mean, you were a flight lieutenant, I presume, but this day?
No, I was a flight sergeant.
Flight sergeant.
Mm.
And where did you wash and keep yourself clean?
Oh, there were some ablutions close by which we had to get to, but again, very primitive, very, very little hot water. The messing was exactly the same. They had a sergeant's mess, but it was primitive. Yes, you can't say anything better than that.
And what were your working patterns like? In how often would you fly, and how often would you be on call, as it were?
Well, we were never on call in those days. You're either flying or you weren't. And so that we'd do so many day trips and then have 2 or 3 days rest and then have night trips. And then you'd go on for those and then have another day off. Because remember once when we came back after we'd been doing night flying for about 10 days, we got to bed about 7 o'clock in the morning, and the next thing I knew, it was about 10 o'clock the next afternoon or the next day. So that's how tired we were.
And you said there was a Polish squadron as well.
Yeah.
Did you mix much with them?
No. No, they're a feisty lot. In fact, one of them nearly knifed me. That was because he was paying undue attention to one of the wafts, and I jumped in silly-like, and before I knew where there was, the knife out. But fortunately, his powers pulled him down.
Can you describe the organisation of the base?
Well, you had the station commander as a group captain, and then you had the wing commander flying, the wing commander administration, and the wing commander engineering. And then under the wing commander flying, obviously with the squadrons, the wing commander admin, he was looking after all the paperwork and the rest of it. And wing commander flying was in charge of the servicing of the aircraft. So it evolved all the way down to the squadron and then down to the crews.
And could you describe the organisation of a squadron?
Yes, at the time we had the squadron commander was a squadron leader, and his two sidekicks, his two flight commanders and flight lieutenants, and then the ranks then varied between flight lieutenants down to sergeant pilots. And you didn't necessarily have to be an officer to be captain of an aircraft. You could be captain of an aircraft as a sergeant, and your navigator could be a flying officer. Because once we got into the air, the pilot was boss, regardless. And so that's the way it worked. I don't think it would work in the army, but it certainly worked in the RAF.
And how did you spend your spare time?
Various ways. I mean, we used to borrow the station bicycles and go down to Tintagel or into Campbellford. But there wasn't too much to do there. I think we were far too busy. It was only later on when we moved from David Stonemore that there seemed to be more time to relax. So is that sufficient for David Stonemore?
Well, did you get much leave at that time?
Very little. Very little. It was. It seemed to be non-existent at the time.
How long were you stationed at Davidston?
Oof. Can you stop it? Because I'm getting my logbook.
How long were you at Davidston more?
July, August, September, October. 4 months.
July 42?
October 42.
42.
Yeah.
What happened to
your plan? And then we were converted onto Liberators, the American B-24. First we went up to Alder Grove to do the conversion onto Liberators, which were four-engined aircraft. And then we came back from there, still as a squadron, and went to Thorney Island, where we picked up our own Liberators and got up to operational standard, and then moved back to St Evel in Cornwall.
What was the purpose of training you up on Liberators?
There was still a gap in the Mid-Atlantic, which was not being covered by the air forces of the Allies. And so these Liberators were very long-range Liberators, so we were airborne for 14 hours at a time, which took us far out into the bay.
And was the purpose, again, anti-submarine operations?
Yep, pure anti-submarine. And then eventually they were fitted with what were known as Lee lights, where for night attacks we'd go in, and if you picked up a submarine, you flashed this searchlight on, which was a very powerful one, supposedly was to blind the U-boat crew. And I think that's where we lost a lot of aircraft during that period as well. We arrived at St Evel in January 43. And I was there until July 43. And then I was posted up to Alder Grove to 1674 HCU Heavy Conversion Unit to become an instructor on Liberators. Now, during the time...
Before we move on to that, can you describe perhaps any particular operations in the Atlantic when you were in Liberated?
Well, it was basically the same. I never saw anything like that. The only excitement I had was meeting those eight JU-88s.
So you never came across any U-boats?
No, never saw. Although later on, towards the end of the war, the squadron had quite a few kills. But by that time, I was instructing in Northern Ireland.
When you were doing these operations in the Atlantic, were you supported by other aircraft, the fighter aircraft that helped?
Oh no.
They didn't have a range, I suppose.
Well, no. I mean, we went too far out for the JU-88s. So we were there solo. But when I said solo, there were God knows how many solos flogging around that part of the Atlantic. So again, there was constant cover. What happened eventually is that the U-boats started crawling up the Spanish coast, which we couldn't go into because of. But, I mean, it kept them going, and it was in, I think it was in 1943 that Battle of the Atlantic was finally won. Because that's when we closed the gap.
So you became an instructor in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
How long were you an instructor?
Well, at the... at Aldergrove from July 43 to March 44. Oh, sorry, March 45. So I'm a year out somewhere. I went to Aldergrove in July, stayed on the squadron until I left the squadron in that was 44. I left in 44, Aldergrove, and what happened was that one of the skippers who was converting onto Liberators had done something rather naughty, and so they asked me to take over the crew. And from there, we flew out to the Azores, where we'd got aircraft stationed to do that part of the Atlantic. And so we were there until 1945, when the war ended.
So similar sort of operations?
Absolutely the same, except we never got onto ops down there, because within 2 or 3 weeks of being there, the war ended. The only thing we did do was to have a dirty great big bonfire, and of which we were doing this stupid thing of putting planks on and running through the fire. And of course, living out there, the food was entirely different. I mean, we used to sit down to, oh, God knows how many course dinners, with wines at every course. And it was a very jolly nice time, actually, down there. That was just the way to end the war, as far as we were concerned, anyway.
And we sort of... Flight Sergeant at that time, or
no,
would you be promoted?
No, I got promoted in March 44. Yes, because we were married in April 44. When I got to Aldergrove, I was an officer.
Did you have to do any exams or go through any interviews to become an officer?
Yeah, there was just one interview where I went to... 19 Group Headquarters at Plymouth, where I met up with the CNC of Coastal Command, who interviewed me. And I think, as a result of being one of the initial joiners of the ATC, or ADCC, I got the commission, I think, through that. Because, I mean, having left school at 14 and a half, you wouldn't have thought that was enough education, which it wasn't, quite obviously. But anyway, I happened to be good at the job.
Was it very different being an officer from being an NCO?
It was, yes, it was, but the point being is that the at the time with St Devil, the NCOs and myself at the time were living in a hotel, Porth Bay Hotel, which is a few miles away from St Devil. When we converted onto Liberators, I picked up another co-pilot who was an American, who was in the RCAF, volunteered. And so we were all together in this hotel with one or two more crews. And then I was commissioned, but I still stayed with the crew. I was quite happy staying with the crew. And then Charles, the American co-pilot, he was transferred into the American Army Air Corps and got his commission. And so we decided to move up into the officers' mess then. And he was a very useful chap to have because he could lip read. So he used to sit in the bar and watch what the CO was talking about, and we get up to date and things like that.
So how was it different being an officer?
Well, not really different, because, I mean, you're still with the same crew, but as I say, eventually we were living in the mess as officers, but life.
So what did that mean in terms of your day to day life?
Well, no change at all. You're still. You still went flying, you still had your job to do. The only difference being that instead of sitting at the controls of an aircraft as captain, as a flight sergeant, you're now sitting at the controls of an aircraft as a pilot officer.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of mess life.
Well, that was a question of getting acclimatised to it. I mean, because there'd been no formal training or anything. We hadn't had any officer training as such. So it was a question of getting used to it. But, I mean, a lot of the people were exactly the same as yourself. Okay, they probably had better education, but they'd had no officer training. So it was just a question of all mucking in together, and it worked.
And how did the mess run? How was it run? You know, how was it financed? How did you pay for drinks?
Oh, you paid for drinks over the bar, where you're only allowed to spend so much per month. I think it was £5 at the time.
I mean, did you settle up at the end of each month?
And you settled up at the end of each month. You had your mess bill at the end of each month, which you had to settle up, and if you didn't settle up or overstepped your mark, you were in front of the CO. It's difficult to describe it. And I suppose when we moved into the officers' mess, you had your own room. I think I shared a room with Charles and the American, so the two to a room. But the routine was basically the same.
You ate in the mess?
Ate in the mess, yes.
But what sort of social activities did they have?
There was very little time for social activities. We did have the occasional one, like dining in nights, where there was a certain ritual we had to stick to.
Were you in dress uniform?
Not then, no. Dress uniform was out until after the war. I think on one occasion we had this horse racing thing, whereby you entered a horse and gave it its name and its sire and dam, and then you threw dice. Well, these days it's done on screen, isn't it? And it was that sort of thing, not too much social life. I mean, as far as the going out was concerned, okay, we did it a bit more often because there was a pub a little more close at St Colum Minor, where we used to hive off there, the crew, and sit and have a drink and a chatter and whatnot, and then back to mess again.
What about your uniform?
Uniform in battle dress. But, I mean, we did have to have a number one uniform.
Did you have to buy that yourself?
Yes. Yes, I think when I was commissioned, I was given 10 days. To go home and get one, which we did. So, I mean, we were fortunate in as much as I was commissioned just before we got married.
And what was that like, being married and being in the services?
Betty was at home when I was at war. But Betty, by that time, had joined the fire service. And so it was a question of getting leave when you wanted to. And when the invasion came, it was a question of no leave whatsoever. And when later on in life, when...
Do you mean D-Day?
Yeah, for a whole time before D-Day. When we told the Germans that was what we did, they were shattered. They never stopped their normal routine, which was a quarter of the squadron, both air crew, aircraft and ground crew, were on leave. And we said, oh, sorry, mate, we were not allowed to go home or do anything except fly.
Did Coastal Command play any special part in the D-Day operations?
In the D-Day operations, they closed the western approaches and the eastern approaches of the Channel by doing these patrols, French coast, British coast, and so much so that the U-boats couldn't get through.
Did you participate in...
No, I was in Northern Ireland by then.
You were doing
it? Oh, no, I wasn't. I wasn't. I was in hospital. I'd got a burst eardrum. I was in hospital, so I missed that. And then it was after that one that they took me off operations and sent me to Northern Ireland to become an instructor.
So by the end of the war, you were a flight lieutenant?
Yes.
What happened to you at the conclusion of the war?
At the conclusion of the war, we...
You'd signed on... Not as a
student. No, no, that wasn't on then. It was still wartime service. And what happened was that we flew back from the Azores to St David's in South Wales, where we converted on the Liberators to passenger aircraft. And then our job was to fly replacement airmen and army people out to the Middle East and the Far East, and then bring POWs back and time-expired men back from that area of the woods. And we were doing that until, let's see, until we converted onto Yorks. And that would have been 1946, I presume.
Any memories of that time when you were transporting troops and POWs?
Well, yes. I remember once we had to land at a place called Shaiba, which is at the bottom of the Persian Gulf. Not Shaiba. That came later. Sharjah. And that was a small garrison with... a flight lieutenant as the commanding officer, and sufficient airmen and NCOs as to form either a cricket team or a football team. So when we landed there, we had a specific job to do. We were flying in from Pakistan, from, can't remember the name of the place, to Sharjah to pick up an Iraqi levy, which at that time they were part of our organisation. And he was sick and he had to be flown back to Habania. And so we got him aboard and then got airborne. And I went back to see him, and he was scared out of his wits, because he thought when he went through the cloud, he'd be with Allah. So we got him safely back on that one. And as far as the Liberators were concerned, it was a straightforward, you know, I know it sounds awfully mundane, but we just flew there and we flew back again. You landed at Malta for a start, and then you went on to North Africa, then over to Israel, then over to Iraq, Habania, and then you used to fly over then to Karachi, and then down to Ceylon, and then out to Singapore. It was a routine job. I mean, we did have our moments at certainly the Banya, because we were lucky enough to get there on occasion on a Sunday, where the set piece for Sunday lunch was a real curry, which most of us had never had before, which we thoroughly enjoyed. And as a result of that, if we were overstaying, then the embassy staff would invite us down to their special club. So